This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, and it's another special. Today's conversation is with Dr. Tamsin Lewis. She returns. She went off. She did all my tests. I had a blood test. I had a urine test. I had a saliva test. I had a feces test. I had my whole life tested. My whole medical history tested. Medical makeup tested, and the results are on the podcast today. But not really, because we're going to discuss a lot of stuff on the podcast as well.
You got into quite a lot of stuff, didn't you?
We discussed doping in sport, which I think is really fascinating. And we discussed, there's a lot of different things. I like talking about health. Mark, you like a little bit of health discussion?
I listen to podcasts on that. Joe Rogan, who she mentioned on the podcast, talks about it quite a bit, doesn't he? There's a few things that I've done recently that I've found beneficial. I can't afford all of the tests and stuff, but hopefully Tim Spector's stuff that we've done, that we've spoken about before, hopefully that will be something that can pinpoint, my health issues. That I have terrible health issues, but,
Were you excited about finding out how healthy I was, Mark?
I am.
I feel a bit bad, actually, because I was the guinea pig for it, or to try and work out what all these tests are and how work and everything. But, so you're going to be listening to a bit about how I am and how my health
is. And the words like wee and poo.
Yes, wee and poo. All right, brilliant. Let's have a listen to this. This is Tamsin, Dr. Tamsin Lewis.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to my kitchen, Dr. Tamsin Lewis. Welcome back. You're the only second guest that we've had return to the show. So Dr. Julia Shaw was the other one, who's the expert on memory and how little our memory works. She's always fascinating. I really like her. We've got some more returning guests, but thank you for coming back. I've got your present as always, and it's really easy to buy for you now, because I just know I can buy you balsamic vinegar and you'll be happy because you eat so much of the stuff. So it's the expensive stuff again.
Thank you. I drink it. Yeah.
I know you do. Yeah. I think it's a mental
only vintage,
amount of
though, right? Full of polyphenols.
Why do you do balsamic vinegar again, so much of it?
Couple of things. One, it increases.
Come forward to the mic a bit.
Sorry, I should do that. It increases the acidity in the stomach, which is bizarrely what people don't think is going to help them digest food. But actually, enough acidity in the stomach helps you break down the fats and proteins, helps you get more from your food. So that, and it's full of the good stuff. Full of polyphenols, antioxidants, which all help towards the longevity.
What's polyphenols? Antioxidants is the anti-cancer thing, isn't it? What's polyphenols?
Well, they fit into the same group. So polyphenols are a type of antioxidant. Just
right.
Like that.
Okay.
And they're found in a variety of things, including red wine. And balsamic vinegar.
Mark and myself have, as you know, have been on this clinical trial with Tim Spector, which we're very excited. We haven't got any of the results back yet. But that's all about what's going on in our gut, isn't it?
Well, I think it's observing how your lifestyle is affecting your gut,
yeah,
so much as your what you eat, how you live, and how that is changing the ecosystem that is in your gut, and how that then affects how you feel and function.
How do you feel about supplements and vitamins and things like that? Because there's been a bit of stuff on some stuff on TV the other day, wasn't it, where people were saying that they're pointless. You just get all your vitamin D from the sun, etc., etc. Where do you stand on vitamin supplements?
I think that's a long topic. It was talked about on TV. I can't remember the doctor, but I got a few comments and a few patients writing in saying, but he's told me that I don't need to take any vitamin D and that, essential multivitamins are useless. A few things like that. But actually, having trained as a conventional medical doctor and being shown that you just need certain types of vitamins only when you're sick, I my whole mindset has changed because I've seen the power that strategic, that means having evidence to suggest that they need to be used,
yeah,
can benefit people. And I know I've tried to get you on a supplement regime, but it's difficult because it's hundreds of pills for some people, but I use the term hundreds, but I mean, you know, it can be at least 10 supplements a day, but it's all in the dose, the timing and the reasoning. Okay. So I don't blanket throw supplements at people without knowing why they need it, which is why we started with you with a blood test. So I have some data.
All right. We're going to talk about, for anyone who doesn't know, Dr. Tamsin was on the show before and she went away and we did loads of tests and I'm the guinea pig. And so we're going to do the results a bit later, but we've got a few things to discuss before that. But in the vitamins thing, say you are vitamin D deficient or some of the vitamins that the supplements you've given me, can you just take them for a short amount of time and then your body will then take over, or are you on a regime for the rest of your life?
I always like to separate out between a treatment phase and a maintenance phase. So if you do a test like you and a number of people and see that your vitamin D levels are low, then there is a treatment phase and then a repeat test. And often if you can afford it or your GP is willing to test you to see if you have been responsive to the dose. So take a supplement, test to see if it improves your levels, and then, you know, taper off. A lot of people have higher vitamin D requirements than others. So there's a variability in how much vitamin D you should take. Okay. And that's genetics and that's also lifestyle. So the darker your skin color, the less vitamin D you get from the sun.
Right.
So your requirements are higher. So this is the whole era that I'm fascinated in which I practice of personalized medicine. Mm. What works for you doesn't work for him or her.
Yeah.
So, you know, getting some information, genetic data, blood test data to kind of support why you need to take supplements or medications is helpful.
Tamsin, can I ask you just to move your stool in a bit so you can get a bit closer to the mic? Just because I know we're going to talk.
The microphone, I feel.
Yeah, you'd have to go that close, but it's just because when you go off, because it's a kitchen, it just goes a bit echoey.
Like a nose. I feel like I'm like coming into it.
Anyway. That's it. That sounds really good. Now, two other things I want to ask you, because I keep buying guests.
I might lean on it.
On my podcast, I keep buying guests things that I've been told are good when instead of alcohol. So the first one is I keep buying this things like Manuka honey. Is that sort of stuff good for you? That really expensive, is it Manuka honey, the really expensive honey? Do you know?
Always do this. You say, is that good for me? Is that good for me? Is that good for me? There are lots of things that are good for us. We just can't do everything on a day-to-day basis because you just get overwhelmed.
So expensive.
It's a lifestyle and it's expensive and information is overwhelming for people. So Manuka honey, you asked for one point. Yes, it's a useful substance, but should you have it every day? Probably not, because it's full of sugar and fructose and ultimately it gets metabolized to
that. All right, what about I gave Laurie off the Slave, that was who I gave that to, Jason off Sleaford Mods, Laurie off Slaves, I gave apple cider vinegar, which everyone says is amazing. He's doing a shot of it a day. He says he loves it and he's feeling great. What is the point of doing that stuff? Is that good?
I mean, it's one part of a treatment regime. So apple cider vinegar has multitude of benefits.
Does it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like your balsamic vinegar, similar.
Similar, but it doesn't have the polyphenols. But it, in terms of a digestive, improving the environment within the stomach, absolutely. And it indirectly can reduce the glycemic load. So your insulin response to food. So how much sugar you're absorbing from food. So it's one thing, but does one shot a day make a huge difference to... If you're still going out and partying and eating your McDonald's, probably not. But if you're using it as part of a more healthy lifestyle generally, absolutely.
How's your exercise regime been since I last saw you? Well, since you last been on this podcast, I see you all the time because we share a gym, but you're busy exercising and busy taking part in. You did a triathlon. Am I right in saying you've done an Ironman and two triathlons since the last time you've come on here?
Yeah, see, I'm a recovering exercise addict.
You're not recovering very well. You do so many lengths in the pool. It's incredible.
It's what you're used to, right? I think I do very little now compared to what I did when I was a professional athlete. Right. So, you know, I literally get in the pool for like 20, 30 minutes now and do, you know, a 1 to 2K. But I have dipped my feet back into Ironman triathlon this year. I've done two half Ironmans, not the full distance, because I wanted to see what I could do on very little training and strategic supplementary support, plus the use of these crazy things called ketones, alongside some tracking, for example, the blood glucose monitor that I know you used when you were doing your Tim Spector trial. So I've been trying to kind of get some information about what is possible to do on less.
Okay, tell us first of all what ketones are. You just mentioned them. What's that?
Oh, let's go down that rabbit hole. So this is something called a ketone ester. Mm-hmm. So it's what they call an exogenous ketone. So it's putting a substance called a ketone into your body, which increases the level of the ketone in the blood, which makes your brain feel good. It sustains energy level. Your body can use it as a fuel, just like it uses sugar as a fuel. So it reduces the need for sugar as a fuel in the body. It came out of research that was done with the military at Oxford through DARPA organization, that it could keep the military personnel going for longer without requiring large amounts of food. So it's got increasing interest at the moment using ketones for performance, for brain health. It's something that, you know, a lot of people are looking at, but there needs a differentiation between being in a ketotic state. So if you were on the ketogenic diet, you would produce ketones, which make you feel good.
Right.
You can use ketones, like this ketone drink, if you're not on a ketosis diet, and you get similar benefits.
Okay.
It's a complicated rabbit hole to go down.
Yeah, I think
these
we need
are very expensive things, and they should only be used, you know, strategically.
Okay. What effect are you finding with them? Are you finding it's good?
So I used it initially for a performance benefit. So I used it when I did that Ironman triathlon, and I just felt my energy was sustained longer. I didn't need as much.
Is it legal?
Totally legal, okay. Yeah. It's prohibitive to most because they're like 40 quid a bottle.
Wow.
And it's a startup now that came out of Silicon Valley called Human, HVMN. And I got interested in it because Rhonda Patrick, who I know you listen to quite frequently, she's just an amazing podcast linked to it with Joe Rogan, and she talks about exogenous ketones. So this is a ketone ester, which is different from other ketone salts like beta-hydroxybutyrate. Okay, I don't want to get on that, but all I want to
what
say
is... What is it?
Well, people say that it's a molecule. It's made in the lab that is present in the normal in your body.
Yeah.
So when you go into... When you starve, okay, if you fast...
Right, yeah,
you break down fat.
Yeah.
You then produce ketones as a byproduct of that breakdown of fat, okay? This gives those ketones, so kind of overrides that need to fast.
Yeah.
So you get a similar effect... as if you've gone through a fast and then you get that high. So it gives you quite a nice brain clarity, a nice feel.
So the ketone diet that everybody's discussing, that basically is fasting to get your body to burn fuel in a different way.
People get really confused, and I'm glad you brought this up because I like to distinguish it. So a ketogenic diet is typically a high fat, low carbohydrate diet, okay?
Paleo diet.
Paleo, no. So paleo does allow some carbohydrate.
Right.
So Atkins was the same as a ketogenic diet.
Okay.
It's high fat, low carbohydrate. Over time, you will produce as a byproduct of breaking down the fat, ketones. You do not, fasting is separate, okay? You can be on a ketogenic diet and not fasting because you're eating fat as fuel. It's a complicated picture. So... fasting will produce ketones from your stores of body fat.
Okay.
A ketogenic, high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, you produce the ketones from the fat you eat, the breakdown. So you do not have to be energy-restricted. So you don't have to be calorie-restricted on a ketogenic, high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet.
So you're talking about eating meat and green leafy veg.
And
that's it.
No, additional fats, which fill you up, provide you with the calories and the nourishment to keep you going. So you're not in a breakdown state, which you would be if you were fasting.
So what sort of fats?
Avocado, olive oil, coconut oil, macadamia nuts, Brazil nuts, eggs,
and
tuna, sardines, and salmon.
Do we believe this is good for you?
I think increasingly the evidence is suggesting that it is good to eat that way. I think Atkins got a lot of criticism because they were encouraging a lot of processed meats and, you know, meat consumption generally. And obviously the quality of the meat, where it's sourced from, determines how healthy it is as well. So
when you did your Ironman, you were trying to look at the way your body was functioning via diet and also supplements.
Kind of, a bit of it was just tapping into to that community again, and going, you know, can I get through a 2 kilometer swim, a 56 kilometer bike, and a half marathon on very little training? My past fitness.
All right, so I follow you on Instagram, and I saw you standing on a podium. Did you podium on one of them?
Yes, I did, on the Nice one, but it was...
So you're not training and you still got on a podium?
It was amateur. I almost felt embarrassed.
Why?
And I didn't accept my spot because I qualified for the World Championships there as an amateur. Because, I'm nearly 40 now. Yeah. I've been a pro, although I was working part-time as a doctor at the time. So to go back into it and see the girls who I used to race against... 15, 20 minutes up the road from me, who's now racing as an amateur, I almost just feel like I'll never be there again. So why am I here? Why am I even trying to do this? Right. And it's because you get caught up in the whole Ironman brand. I mean, it's huge. It's a multi-million, if not billion-pound industry now.
So were you disappointed you didn't win the amateur? Where did you come in the...
Yeah, but then I found out the amateur third. But then I found out that the amateurs were like training full time. And I looked at the way they looked. And you need to hear this, okay? Because we talk about this all the time, right? Excessive endurance exercise does not give you, especially as you age, a healthy physiology and physique. You know, the women did not look feminine. And you know, please don't anyone take this as a criticism, because it's fine not to look feminine if you choose that.
Yeah.
But... you know, I do like to maintain a bit of femininity, a bit of body fat. And the women that won it, I mean, they were just ripped, 9% body fat. Don't believe they'd seen a period for a while. And their skin looked very aged. You know, that's what endurance sport, especially in the sun, does to you. It breaks down.
Does that worry you when you were doing endurance sports?
It definitely aged me. And I did a lot of blood testing, and we put it through some software called the blood chemistry calculator, which we did with you, which essentially predicts stuff from your blood tests, including a biological age. And I was, my biological age was something like 15 years older than I am.
Wow.
Yeah. And that is mostly because I'm in what they call a chronic state of catabolism, or was, which basically means breakdown, high stress hormone levels, low female sex hormone levels, which is common in people, female athletes as they age. And all of that, my antioxidant levels were low, all of those kind of things. There was too much stress going on in my body.
Is that reversible?
It is. So whilst I'm very cardiovascularly fit, or was, actually from a longevity, living well longer perspective, I certainly wasn't, the thinning skin, drying skin, wrinkles, you get signs of premature aging, but you've got low body fat and you're very fit, so people think you're healthy. I don't think that's the case.
Oh, I wonder what the endurance athletes listening to that would make of that then.
Well, I'm obviously I'm not the first person to talk about this. Peter Attia talks about it quite a lot. It's one of the reasons he's given up doing crazy long endurance events.
Is there a tipping point?
I reckon it's around, it's around the sort of 40. I think that's the
point. But I wonder how much exercise. I listened to a podcast once with a guy, and I can't remember who it is. I listen to so many podcasts, as you know, like yourself. And this guy was saying he believes 20 minutes a day is maximum exercise. Anything over that is dangerous for you. And I was like, what? 20 minutes a day? No one does that. Anyone who goes to the gym does an hour, or so.
I think that's ridiculous, giving binary information like that, because I don't think it's applicable to anyone.
Yeah.
But people like numbers, and they like, tell me what to do.
Tell me 20 minutes. Everyone does, because it makes sense to us.
Moving more throughout the day is much better from you, and this is what we know from the research, than going to the gym for an hour and sitting at your computer for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
A lot of us do that, but we're not designed to do that. So you'd be better off doing 15 minutes in the morning, going for a walk at lunchtime, doing some press-ups or squats or something in the afternoon, encouraging little bits of movement and activity into your day rather than just going at it and then retreating and sitting down all day.
So tell us about the time that you didn't podium. What happened? Bike problems? Yeah, bike problems, didn't you?
Oh, I'm notorious for bike problems. I generally have podium most of the time. I did Mallorca, half Ironman Mallorca in April, May. Yeah. But that was, I had a sort of crisis of confidence on the run, okay, because I came off the bike first and then I felt embarrassed because I was leading and I was an amateur and then I had a bit of a walk and then...
You were leading the pros?
No, there was not the a pro race. All right, okay, there, so you were leading... So I was the leading woman.
And then you came off the bike.
And then I just felt a bit bizarre because I hadn't done a race in 4 years, like a triathlon. I was leading it and then my stomach hurt a bit, so I had a walk and I was just basically chatting to people on the side of the road and then I just jogged it in. But still came fourth.
I thought your bike broke or something.
My bike
didn't you have a... Didn't your bike snap or something, or the wheel snap or something? I thought you told
not on that event. I've had that happen previously. but
you've come off your bike as well recently, haven't you?
Oh, yes. I sliced my leg open.
It's quite dangerous, isn't it? Cycling and triathletes and actually cycling. There's a lot of injuries, a lot of collarbones and things snapped.
I've broken my collarbone a few times, yeah. But the irony is from this bike accident, it was actually happened whilst carrying the bags from the Ironman event back to where I was staying on the front of my bike and I fell over and sliced it on the chainring.
So what did you learn about competing without training then? Obviously, you still can do it.
I learned that it feels quite a lot harder. It depends really on your mindset, how hard you want to push yourself. And, you know, some of the best athletes are able to push themselves to the point of near death and then retreat, you know, overcoming that central governor, as we call it in the brain, and sort of pushing yourself past the pain barrier. But, you know, that is a form of, you know, almost like a form of self-abuse. And I'm not in the place in my life where I want to abuse or myself anymore, put myself into a place where it's harder to retreat from. To backpedal when you've caused that much damage is hard.
But you have that mental capacity to just keep going.
I have a very strong endurance engine, which is partially genetic, my dad, and partially because of the...
Just to remind people, your dad used to ride in the Tour de France. He was a pro rider and stuff. So yeah, he's has that stuff. I did a Watt bike test once at Watt bike. And they get you to do the... remind me, what's it called?
VO2 max test.
VO2 max test. So you push yourself as hard as you can for... What's the period you do it? Like, is it a minute or something? You go as hard as you can so they can get it. Is it a minute? I don't know, however long
it was.
The
whole thing lasts 20 and they ramp it up.
That's it, yeah. So 20 and ramp it up. And they said, when James Cracknell did it, as we all know, Olympian, he just didn't stop. He carried on going, even though he was at max. He just kept going. When they go to you, stop, you can just stop and go, oh God, because it's so much pain. He kept on going through the pain. Mm. And I was told by Matthew Pinson that when they row, it starts hurting from about 30 seconds in. And then the rest of the race is just pure pain. And it's how you deal with the pain is
learning to be comfortable with the pain. I mean, pain is what pain is a perception, right?
How mad is that though?
It's a perception.
So is
that there for a reason, right? It's there to stop you killing yourself. But if you know that you're not going to die and there's people to pick up the pieces, you can push yourself and stay at that limit.
Right. So when you're looking at the Brownlee brothers or any of the elite athletes, are they in pain because that's how they win?
Absolutely. But I think all of these, there's different things there. They have the mental capacity to push themselves to the ultimate limit, but they also have some kind of genetic, inverted commas, freakery that gives them an edge. All of those top level professional athletes know how to deal with pain. Yes, I guess that, I mean, there's the people that are working with specifically psychologists might be able to push a bit further. But, you know, I mean, it's very hard to say because all of them at that top end of the game, as I said, are there for a reason because they know how to control their pain.
Do you miss the pain?
I miss that feeling of complete and utter exhaustion and giving it everything for the line. There's a really good picture of me like at the end of a half Ironman in France. It was a really hard one. And there was something like $3,000 between second and third. And I was literally caught the girl on the line, like literally, but I gave it everything. And I remember that feeling. And, you know, once you've done that, it is a drug high, right? You chase that, but I don't get that anymore.
But that high you got by doing that, what did she feel like by losing it? I mean, when you push yourself through all that pain and you don't quite get the place, how does that feel?
Yeah, it feels pretty horrible, but she was in the medical tent for an hour or so, pretty out of it.
That just seems so mad to me that you watch the guys finish the races and they just exhaust, the exhaustion hits and and you sit on, you just think, wow, you've put your body through absolute hell there. Is it worth it? Clearly it is. Mentally, it's worth it.
I think to go back from an evolutionary perspective, we were used to going to war, and it was hard whether you won or lost, but that sense of achievement, of battle, of camaraderie, of spirit, that's what a lot of people are in this for.
I suppose we're humans 3.0 though now, aren't we? We're not being chased by dinosaurs and lions and stuff, so we don't really need that buzzing.
No, but maybe we need it. We do still. And that's why we're chasing other highs, I think. Yeah. I think that's the way, you know, that hardwiring, that biochemistry, that, you know, DNA of us is not changing in that much in the time span that we're discussing.
I asked for some questions for you, and I've got one here that I think is really good, so I'm going to do this. KH Counseling tweeted in to say, "Hi Tim, would be interested to know how Tamsin overcomes the negative messages of the mind whilst competing in endurance events, and does breath work help?" Now, let's take that in two parts. So first of all, do negative thoughts come into your head as you're pushing yourself through all the pain?
I think I wouldn't be human if I said no, you know, that didn't happen. I think it happens for everyone. You've just got to be able to, it's a constant sort of play between staying in with the pain and then externalizing your pain. It's so, you know, constant. I often say people, it's a classic sports psychology tool. You externalize when your thoughts. So when you're like constantly in your head and you're like, ow, this hurts, you know, I'm never going to get there. And then, you know, I've still got that this far to go. You have to kind of, one, stay in the moment, focus on what you can control. So your pedal rate, if you're on the bike, for example, how many calories you're consuming, you know, what you're eating and drinking. And then, you know, take a moment to actually look around you and see and take in the environment, maybe the beauty, the people around you, rather than, you know, staying right in with the pain at the moment. So that happens to me all the time. It happened to me in Nice. I was on the bike going, oh, I don't need to do this anymore. You know, it's uncomfortable. And then, you know, you have to learn from experience, and you know that once you're at the finish line, the days afterwards, you're going to be so proud of what you've done. That's really reinforcing. So I would say to people, try when you have those thoughts to think about what you can control in the moment in terms of, like I say, the flow. If it's running, you know, your foot strike, the way you hold your body, your breathing. And also to think about positive things in your life, you know, bring color to the event.
Okay, so you used to and still work in a bit mental health. That was your job. So that's how you go through life as well, I suppose, is it? Think about the positive, stay in the moment.
Yes, and I should probably answer the second part of the question, which we didn't, which was about breath work. I mean, obviously doing breath work when you're in an endurance event is hard, but the point of concentrating on your breathing takes your mind, a bit like yoga, right? Takes your mind away from that, those thought processes which go on this trajectory, on this rabbit, on this hamster wheel of, this hurts, I feel crap, I'm not going to be any good, she's going up the road, you know, he's going up the road, I can't catch them. You know, that competitive, all that thought process, if you just bring it back to what in the moment you can control, I think that's, and thinking about the sense of gratitude, love, all the positive things in your life, I think that really does help. And I have, you see, you talk about mental health. I mean, obviously that is my background. That's where I started in medicine, you know, because I felt that I needed time to spend with people to uncover their why. And unfortunately, mental health was too limited for me because in the conventional sense, it's very much focused on diagnosing, categorizing, and drug regimens, you know, pharmaceuticals. It always, this whole approach, as I mentioned last time, the biopsychosocial was always what I was about. Taking some of your biology, so that's testing, blood testing, looking what's out of balance there. And the psychology is sort of engaging with people, getting their trust, exploring their personality, exploring their history, because that affects the biology, right? So the two interplay. If you push up one, the other one changes. And then the sociology is environment, is lifestyle, it's relationships, it's all those things. So this is like web of life, okay? And one affects the other. As I said to you, sometimes when we change people's biochemistry, blood tests, improving vitamin D levels, changing hormone levels. That changes your filter of the world, which then helps you progress into a different life. Mm. Sometimes it can improve motivation, confidence, interactions.
Just going back to endurance quickly, I did some cycling and I've done some swimming, but swimming, pretty rubbish. Cycling, even worse. And some running.
You're not that bad. You're being down on yourself. I've not seen you swim.
I'm not great, but my
cycling. That's how we met. Discussing swim technique in
exactly,
the sauna.
Exactly right. But I was cycling, and I just brought back those memories there of me being so uncomfortable on a 4-hour cycle. I hated it. That I would do anything but try and cycle. I'd fidget. I'd pick up my water bottle, put it down, move around, do this, do that. Alter my costume, my outfit, my kit, fidget. Anything to try and distract myself from the fact that I was cycling. I suppose that separates people like me and you who stay in the, they call it a flow, isn't it? You get in the flow, you're in the zone, and you're going, okay, I can do this. I'm uncomfortable, but I'm going to keep pushing through because this is what I do. That it's a mindset, is it?
It is, but I think, you know, for you, it was just at that time, I think it was just another painful thing for you to have to do, to force yourself into. And you wanted to do that for your own, you know, self-esteem, confidence, distraction, whatever. But at the end of the day, it was still stressful and you had a lot of other stressful things in your life. Mm. And telling a body to go, right, you know what, I'm just going to put you on another stressful thing now. No wonder it was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So, you know, part of that is learning to be kind to yourself.
Which reminds me about my swim with Duncan Goodhue, which was horrific. I got out of the pool with Duncan Goodhue and my body was just, I couldn't tell you how much pain I was in. He got out about 20 minutes before me, but there you go. All right, just for anyone, we do train at the same gym. So the difference between watching Tamsin train and other people train is phenomenal. She's a elite athlete. I remember going one day, just a quick story. We said we were going to have a chat about my results and stuff. And you said, I'm just going to go for a quick swim. I was watching a football match at the gym. I was halfway through the first half of the match, went all the way through then. I went all the way through half time, all the way through the second half, and you were still having your short swim. So that's an hour.
That's not typical.
That's an hour's worth of swimming. That's flow state.
That's flow state. I'm at the point now where I don't force myself into any type of exercise. I do it because it makes me feel good. I want to leave the session feeling energized, not depleted.
Yeah.
That is the key thing to differentiate.
But you're monotonous. It's just in a nice way. You're just down the pool, change, come back up the pool, you know, and you do your breathing stuff, which is unbelievable. You hold your breath for loads of strokes and stuff. I watch you do it, and you breathe every 2 strokes, then every 3, then every 4, then every 5, and then back down again, up and down, up and down.
Yeah, up to 8, and then 8, 6, 4. And what we know is that buildup of lactic acid after holding your breath for 8, it actually means you get an adaptation, you get a training benefit through have to do less volume. But if you're holding your breath, that lactic acid exposure means that you get fitter from doing less.
If you're an amateur,
plus slightly pseudo euphoric, you know.
Is it?
I mean, if you that breath you get again after holding your breath, that is. It's very primal. Right. Try it. I mean, try doing some breath holding or swimming underwater for as much as you can, and breaststroke try and get up to a length.
Oh yeah, that's fine. But actually to swim 8 strokes and keep on swimming for the length of time you do. If you're an amateur swimmer, try it. It really hurts. Even when you get up to 5 and 6, it's just absolutely painful.
It's painful, and it kind of overrides a very natural reflex to gasp for breath.
Yeah, you feel like you're drowning and suffocating. It's horrible. Let's face it. It's really not nice. Try it, everyone. Let's talk quickly about, because you obviously know a lot about supplements. You're talking about the ketone stuff. When you're on the amateur circuit now, doing triathlon or Ironman.
Which I'm not doing anymore of.
You're not doing anymore of. Is there doping going on? There must be, because I watched that documentary called Icarus, where he tried to do it. Was it called Icarus?
Yeah, it was called Icarus. Everyone knows that. They did that gave good exposure.
It's great. So do you think when you're out there, because the advantages of it are so high, well, let's talk about that in a minute, but do you think people are doping on the amateur circuits of all these things? They must be, right?
Oh, they definitely are. I don't think it's as common as people would think, but I think that is definitely happening. They did a study at the Ironman 70.3 European Championships held in Germany. I think it was 2003 14 and I was there, and I remember filling out the survey and I just couldn't believe the results, because it was something like 30% of all people had tried some performance enhancing substance and they admitted to it. It was an anonymous survey,
right,
but they admitted to it. So these are things like, you know, like testosterone, DHEA, other anabolic steroids, EPO. I think EPO use is very uncommon because it's very difficult to get right. From what I hear, you know, I learned a lot about illicit drug use through growing up with a father who was a professional cyclist who was didn't ever do drugs, but he was Tom Simpson, who famously died on the Ventoux Domestique. And so he lived with drug misuse constantly. So I learned a lot about it through that.
Domestique is one of his team who
he lived with him. He gave him, you know, his last Coke before he died. You know, it was fairly dramatic. And there's a wonderful evocative book written about it, Put Me Back on My Bike, which discuss all we've discussed about the power of the mind, you know, put me back on my bike even though I'm pretty much dead.
Yeah.
And then cycling a few more steps up the road and then falling off and dying. Mind over matter. So do I think performance drug use is common? Yes, but actually most of it, and I do still work with some professional athletes and some high-level amateur athletes, and actually they're all very anti. They all like very wanting to be clean, but maybe that's just the people that come to me because they want to do it properly, you know, through supplements, through testing. But in, you know, I have raced against people that have been known drug users.
But what is clean? And what is that? Like vitamin D, ketone? What is the, where does the advantage stop and the cheating?
Well, it's a very clear line set by the World Anti-Doping Association.
Is what?
Which you can look up online through the
Global
Drone.
I know, but how are they deciding whether one drug's all right for you?
And well, often they decide too late. You know, some teams are on things that only a bit like Sharapova. You know, they only at the point of her taking that drug, it was not banned. And then they knew that she was taking it and they found evidence that it was performance enhancing. So are there, I mean, if people are that invested as an amateur into improving their performance and working with a world-class doctor, then they could be on all sorts of substances that the World Anti-Doping Authority do not know about yet, that are in research, that are used in rats. We know that PPRA inhibitors, for example, there's things that are in the research that people are using.
So it's impossible to track this stuff, really, isn't it?
I think that the authorities, it would be too expensive to track it properly. We know, you know, even though it's my time as a pro, I think I had two blood tests. It's much more common now, but... You know, definitely for in the amateur field, the testing is just couldn't keep up with the drug misuse. And, you know, there's some warped doctors out there that give you what they call therapeutic use exemptions, TUEs, so that you can use testosterone.
What's the solution? I mean, the British cycling team, or Team Sky, I think it might have been, isn't it sort of the average rate of asthma in the country is 10% or something like that? I'm making these figures up, by the way, but the Sky team is 80% or something, because if you do
Subutamol,
if you take that drug, it's going to be good for you. So
the press do pick up on these things and kind of highlight them or inflate them to something they're not quite, because salbutamol, anyone that, if you take 10 puffs of a, or 50, I think Froome was done for, you try taking 50 puffs of a blue salbutamol inhaler, you'd be on the floor. It makes your heart race, it makes your potassium drop, and it's not very nice. So it would only be one tool amongst a whole range of things they use. They use these. There's a Cycling Weekly article talking about the use of ketone esters.
Yeah.
They use supplements.
So when do they decide?
Probably use infusions.
When are they going to decide that's going to be banned?
They can't ban it because
why do they ban things anyway? Because they're harmful to humans, or because they're perceived as cheating?
I think if they can show a significant enough performance benefit. So, for example, I mean, testosterone is a huge one, right? It increases the thickness of your blood. You can carry more oxygen. It increases muscle strength. It reduces lean body mass. It's big, but small things like, you know, vitamin D would have a tiny benefit in comparison to things like EPO and testosterone.
So why is that not cheating?
Because they're natural, I guess they're more natural substances. Mm. One, they're not prescribable.
Mm.
Testosterone is a prescribed drug. EPO is prescribed drug, both hormones.
Okay, so what are the big ones we know, EPO?
But these people want to do it because it makes them feel superhuman.
Right.
I remember a pro cyclist telling me... that he felt completely different after a cycle of HGH, so it's growth hormone and EPO. I mean, you become a different being.
And if you get caught...
But it doesn't turn a cart horse into a racehorse.
Right, yeah. Okay, you need talent first.
You need talent
and
drive,
training and all that. You need the right mentor.
So
Lance Armstrong was still an extreme elite athlete, and this just gave him a little advantage.
And one would argue that he also got more money, and therefore he was able to afford more better doctors and nutritionists and drugs to be able to manipulate it, because this is all complex. I mean, the kind of medicine I practice is really complex and expensive, because there's so much testing. There's different things you put in, and then there's the close relationship you have with the client to work them out.
So I did this on a sports panel once. I discussed this, and basically all the athletes on it were saying it should be a lifetime ban. And the reason why they came up with the idea it should be a lifetime ban, if you get caught ever, is because once you've trained to a certain level, you have a muscle memory, a brain memory that you can train to that level. So even if you're not taking the drug, you're still able to get to a level that you couldn't get without taking the without doping. Is this true, do you think?
Well, this is what the evidence suggests, that any anabolic steroid use or testosterone use has a degree of muscle memory. Yeah. But so if you were to provide the body with the right training stimulus in the future and nutritional support, you would be at an advantage, from a higher advantage than someone that hadn't done that. However, psychologically, and I know this from speaking to people who have tried things in the past and then come off them, you never get that same feel that you got back psychologically when you were taking performance enhancing drugs.
So should it be a lifetime ban, do you think? Is that an unfair question to ask you?
I do not think that it should be. I'm always a big believer in second chances, and I think people can act quite impulsively, and if you don't know better, you could take on advice from someone who you trust.
Yes.
And then get carried away. So I do believe people should be given second chances. I think, you know, if you've done it two times, three times, I think you have to start being a bit more. But, you know, this is a very complex question, because, as you say, the line is so fragile between what's legal, what's not.
Yes. So mere mortals like me who don't understand these things, you start getting thought that, hold on, if I go and take a load of EPO or something, I can compete against Lance Armstrong, which, as we know, is nonsense. What is it that it's actually doing? What are the drugs actually doing to make you a better athlete? Is it just about better recovery?
No, it does different things depending on what you are taking.
Right.
So, for example, you know, testosterone is a commonly used performance enhancing drug, or derivatives of it, like Anavar, an anabolic steroid.
Right.
That has two effects. I touched on it before. It improves hematocrit, red blood cell count in the blood. Red blood cells carry oxygen. The more of them that you have, then the better able you are to carry oxygen and deliver oxygen around the body. So you are a stronger, more efficient athlete. Okay. So your VO2 max would go up. So that's one effect of testosterone. It thickens the blood. You might have heard of the concept of hematocrit, of 50% being the legal limit. If you go above that, it's banned, because that's a sign that you're probably doping. So testosterone thickens the blood, increases your red blood cells. It also has a direct impact on muscle strength and tone. So you get stronger more easily. It also seems to reduce body fat. So that's body composition effect. And then it has the third effect, of the effect on the mind. So we know when people have higher testosterone levels, they're more motivated, they're more aggressive, they're more risk-taking, and they're able to push through pain more. So on the converse to that, if you have low testosterone levels, then you're more likely to have lower motivation, lower mood, lower muscle strength, and you're more likely to have retreat more and not put yourself
out. Okay, so I'm reluctant to ask this question, but I'm going to anyway. So if you start putting testosterone in men, they become kind of these great big giant men, Neanderthal type, strong guys with a good mindset or whatever, and stronger muscles. If you start sticking it in women, doesn't that start kind of change the
everything?
They start turning into men.
Well, okay, two things here. Remember the athlete, Semenya,
yes,
the intersex athlete,
yeah,
who was doing phenomenally well, but she had high testosterone levels normally because she had testicles which were producing testosterone. And she was doing really well. And then they said, well, actually, you can't have your testosterone levels this high because you're competing against people that are naturally lower. So they gave her something to block that, and her performances declined dramatically. So that's a classic one. There, secondly, you know, in the sort of Russian doping,
yeah,
that was talked about on the Icarus, all of those athletes that were doped, you know, quite religiously in that period, then started actually to request sex changes. I mean, it was crazy. It had effects on their mental state, the physiology, the women who were put on testosterone. You know, they then.
So I suppose in a way it's a bad thing for men to do, but really bad thing for women to do. Worse.
Listen, I don't like being binary. You know this about me, and I know that people like to hear black and white.
Yeah, okay.
But there's a monitoring thing here, right? Yeah. You know, a lot of the leading hormone replacement doctors use small amounts of testosterone in people because it does all the good things. But if you go off the charts and start using too much, you're then going to have the aggressive, risk-taking behavior. You're going to lose your hair because dihydrotestosterone affects the hair loss. You know, but actually a small amount in people that are deficient has huge effects on mood, motivation, all the good stuff.
Is it killing sport though? I mean, because when you see someone do extremely well at the Olympics, you start going, yeah, right, they've been doping, haven't they? And when you see a country doing really well, it's a problem for us as viewers, isn't it, and spectators?
It is hugely, but it also makes the sport, I guess, it makes it more interesting. I mean, Matt, you know, those days of Lance on the bike with Landis. I mean, it was just incredible, those feats of performance. It's a very ethical, philosophical question.
He's the one who let us down the most. He's such a
because he lied. It was just the intensity of
lied. Yeah, but then he also bullied everybody around him, which was horrible. He was the kind of number one narcissist of the world. He made everyone's life hell. Anyone who came up and said, Lance, we think you're doing this, anyone in his team who didn't, according to all the documentaries. But there must be a stage that you're sitting there. I've always thought this, when you're lying there after a day's racing, and you've got your blood on the wall and you're putting more blood into you, there must be that stage where you think, I'm not sure this is right. I think we might be cheating here. That just sounds nonsense, putting fresh blood into yourself, unless everyone's allowed to do it. I mean, it's just absolute nonsense in that.
But I think you get into a world, into a way, a very narrow way of living.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is... This was brought up in, not so much in the Icarus one, David Miller's film, that's the time trial that came out. He talked a lot about this. I mean, you have a very narrow world.
Your
environment is controlled, and that's all you see. It becomes your normal.
I'm reluctant to criticize people too much because everyone has that. You're right. Everyone has their different thing. But Lance, I think, is really an exception because people keep trying to get him back into the news. And I just think he lets so many people down, all of us down, because we all sat there and go, he's the most amazing athlete ever.
Yeah.
And he probably was as well, wasn't he? That's the problem. Anyway, let's move on from
that. Well, I mean, that is a personality. That's a narcissistic personality disorder. And can people change? Yes. And I think he has done some work. If people are willing to do some, you know, to recognize that in themselves and do some psychotherapy,
therapeutic
analysis. Can we forgive? I always like to forgive.
Oh, yeah, but
spend
some time looking up narcissists. They actually like that stuff about themselves. So
they like people giving the intention back.
Yeah, I think depends how far you're
Lance
gone.
Lance has been through therapy. He's a new person.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of... It attracts a lot of people. A lot of narcissists get attracted into sport, obviously, for the reasons of what it stands for. Let's talk about
and all the validation that comes with it.
The love, yeah.
You know what? You know, having been in that world... it's very hard, you know, when all people, oh, you're amazing, you did this, you did that. And that is addictive in itself. But, you know, one's need for external validation has a psychological basis. That's, you know, people saying, look, you're this, you're that, you did this, and associating who you are with what you've achieved.
Yeah, defining yourself by that. Let's talk about your business. How's that going? Because explain what your business is to anyone who wasn't watching the first podcast.
I don't really... like to talk about it as a business, but it's evolving into that just because of what, you know, the way it's gone. But essentially have a consultancy which is evolved out of my way of looking at different people through this biopsychosocial approach and helping people, you know, live better within the context of them. And, you know, for example, so I take, at the moment, the business is called Fiber Health. It's actually, that business is dissolving in the next few months. I have a new business partner called Victoria Fenton, who is the COO of the company, and she is a trained naturopath and functional medicine practitioner. She's very knowledgeable, very smart, very quick, very organized. So what we're doing is creating packages for people which are based on those different pillars that we talked about. So some of the blood testing, gut testing, hormone testing, and then we use relevant genetics. All the stuff you've done, and then teasing out of each bit of test data the kind of the blueprint of you. And then with that, working with people to change their lifestyle, their diet, adding in strategic supplements where people are deficient or out of balance, and then looking at how we change up the hormone function as well. So how to get your hormones to work for you. So those are the different...
And why are we dysfunctional?
You've jumped off the question. Let me finish on about
the
business.
Sorry, go on.
So the way the business is evolving is to try and get how the data speaks to who you are. And this is the whole personalized medicine, which is the future. And I'm not proclaiming to be able to solve any part of that. But what I'm doing is encouraging people to, you know, be more engaged with their health data and to understand it. Because the amount of people that come to me and said, well, my doctor did my bloods and they said they were all fine. I'm like, well, did you get the results? Do you know what your iron level was? Do you know what your vitamin D level is? Doctors in general practice are designed to keep us, you know, as to control disease and to help disease. And a lot of people go there and they're not particularly sick. So the conventional medicine system doesn't have an answer for them. We're about trying to get you more optimal so that you don't develop these, you know, the common diseases of, as you do, which people do when they get older.
So we're going to go through some of my stuff in a minute, but why isn't everyone just perfect? Their hormones level is perfect, their blood's perfect, all those sort of things. Why are we, what's happening to us then?
Well, I think the more you look, the more you find.
Yeah.
So there is a part of that too, you know, that the science is so accelerated now so that we're able to access information about people that we weren't before. So I think to answer that question, it is a difficult one. I think the environments in which we live are increasingly not how we were designed to, from an evolutionary perspective. We live in very closed environments. We're exposed to a lot of pollution. We sit a lot. We close off our hip flexors a lot. Our postures are terrible.
Yeah.
You know, we're very externally driven now as a society. So the definitions of success, financial success, I think that plays a big part. I think the quality of the nutrition we have on a daily basis has reduced. You know, we're not eating off the land as much anymore. We're eating out of plastics. You know, the quality of the produce is far less. I think that's a big part of it. Stress, sleep dysfunction, I know you had Matt Walker on because he's amazing. You know, that's a huge pillar of it too. And our sleep is disrupted because... You know,
I haven't had Matt Walker on yet.
Sorry, talked to me about Matt
Walker. I'm desperate to get him on. I've tried to get him on. I've had Dr. Mir Krigan, who talks a lot about sleep. He's the guy from America. He's written all these books about it, which is similar to what Matt Walker does. Sleep's so important. It's turning out to be really important.
It is, but now people are getting stressed about the fact they should be sleeping better. So it's like, you know, how much do you do? I mean, you need to do the key things. You need to be aware that you have a sleep problem, and then you need to put in the tools to try and change it. But, you know, obsessing, waking up in the night and looking at your...
Prince Harry's wearing a sleep ring. Is that what it is? What's that? What's that? What's the ring he's wearing?
So Prince Harry's wearing something called the Aura Ring. This has come out in the press the last few days. The Aura Ring is something that that leading integrative medicine doctors and, you know, just motivated individuals are using to track their stress and their sleep on a day-to-day basis. So I met the founder at a Finnish conference, they're a Finnish company, with Ben Greenfield, the famous biohacker, 2.5 years ago now. And when I looked at them then, I was like, this is something special because it proclaimed looks at the changes in blood flow in your finger, you wear it. It links to a nice, neat dashboard on the phone.
Yeah.
And the reason it's useful for practitioners is because you can become a coach of the client, that if you were working with them, for example, if your client had an Oura Ring, you can become a coach. You can see their heart rate variability, which is a measure of fight, flight versus rest and digest.
Mm.
So too much stress, sympathetic nervous system, flight, fight, flight.
Yeah.
Your heart rate variability, interestingly, goes down. So, and the higher the heart rate variability, the more you're more focused, calm. So having that information means that you're able to show people the effect that their life is having them on a day-to-day basis. So to kind of extrapolate from this and to say, why would Prince Harry be using it? You know, he's someone that appears to be very engaged with his health and the way he eats and exercises, and obviously is aware, given that he's talked about mental health in the press recently, on how the way you think affects the way you feel. And, you know, tracking that through this stressful tour that he's on is probably very insightful.
Oh, the guy who runs that company must be so happy. The prince is wearing his ring. He's got worldwide press. That's got to be the best thing ever. What a great endorsement. And also, especially as you know, you're a prince, you can't get paid for wearing it. So he's clearly just wearing it because he wants to do it. So it's, that's
they do have a problem though, but given that I've got probably about 30 clients who use the Auras now, and there's a wait list
because
the technology cannot keep up with the demand, you know, because they've got some leading biohackers, Peter Attia being one of them, wearing these rings, and then they talk about it and people go, well, I want one. I've been waiting for mine for 2 months and we're at the front of the queue because I know the Aura ring producers. Mm. But you know, that the demand, they can't keep up with the demand at the moment.
Talking about technology, it's really interesting because I had a chat with you. All this stuff is, by the way, is expensive at the moment. And I know you're keen to get the prices down. That's what you want, is everyone masked to be able to analyze themselves eventually. AI is what we need, isn't it? That's kind of, the more you can put my blood tests and my saliva tests and stuff into a computer and you can get the results out, the cheaper it's going to get. Is that correct?
Kind of correct. AI, and I've come across this so many times trying to automate my brain. AI needs to be trained by someone. Unless you've got volumes of data, you still need to write the rule system to tell it what to look for.
Yeah.
And at the moment, we don't have, I say we, I mean integrative medicine doctors, functional medicine doctors generally, no one's collating the information from your genetics, your blood, your microbiome, and how you feel, right? But companies are trying to. There was one company I was involved in, but sadly it done it wrong, and they went under a company called Amixi. But you know, Google, Apple, Amazon are all looking at this, and Apple Health, for example, you know, in the States allows you to put your blood tests in it. But at the moment, it's just a storage interface.
Right.
No one's making any strategic links between it all, because we just don't know yet. People like you who will do these tests start giving us the information so we can see the link between, you did this study with Spectre, right? You know, he looked at your glucose, he looks at your gut, he's looking at how your glucose fluctuates in correlation between what you're eating. So,
well, I love it all. I don't mind giving my information away, but a lot of people are very careful and they're like, oh, no one can have any of my results or any of my bloods or anything, and they're scared of the future and giving out, understandably, I suppose. So, you know, it might be a bit of a problem with people signing off the rights to people analyzing their bloods and things and collecting
I totally agree, unless you can be sold on the fact that it's in a preventative model. I mean, people, for example, like you had with this high iron level ferritin, right? That over time can cause liver and other organ damage. You wouldn't have known about that unless you did a test with someone like me or ad hoc with a medical check.
Okay, let's get into me then, as you've just started bring it up. And I don't mind sharing my results here with you.
And I don't have them up in front of me, so I'm doing this off the top of my head.
So yeah, let's just do it generally anyway. I was the guinea pig and I did 4 tests here. I did blood, saliva, urine tests, and feces. So let's go through all 4 of them. What are you looking for? And then give me some sort of gauge, rough results, and then what we can do about it. So let's start with blood. When you took my blood, so I had bloods at the doctor. They're quite basic. Then suddenly I go and do bloods with you, and I seem to get this reams of results come through. It's much more detailed, isn't it, the blood tests you do. What are you looking for in the bloods?
So we're looking, you know, you obviously rule out disease. So if there's anything really red, you then say, right, you need to go and see your GP, or you need to be referred to a suitable specialist. That could be things like, you know, if your blood cell count's very low or very high, for example. So saying that we've excluded disease, we then look at how we can improve your blood to improve how you feel. So we ask how you, you know, take a baseline. How are you? You're okay, bit tired, bit stressed, bit run down. And then you look at, one, how thick your blood is. And I think for you, you know, you had a quite a high hemoglobin, a high hematocrit. You then had a high, what they call ferritin level, the iron storage protein. Now, you know, in a conventional means, it wasn't high enough for them to go, you know, it's a problem, but it will be a problem as you age because you're not losing iron.
I'm storing too much iron.
Yes, and that might be a genetic thing. We haven't gone through in detail your 23andMe data because I've got it and we have to push it through something else. I'm going to take a breath there. But there is something called the hemochromatosis gene, which is quite common in people, especially Irish origin. And that means you extract and store more iron in the blood. And once, in the body. So it comes out of the blood and your body pushes it into places like the liver. Having too much iron in the body over time can cause damage to the organ because it's like you've seen things rust, right? Mm. That's kind of what happens in a cellular process. It makes everything else more sluggish. So you don't want that. And unfortunately, this is one of the things that got picked up on the TV doctor the other day. He basically said everyone should take an iron supplement, which is total nonsense because the more testing you do in people that are well, you see people with high iron levels, especially men. Women, not so common because they lose it.
Yeah. So I've always been reluctant to give blood because I often feel tired. And yeah. One of the solutions to this is you say that I should be giving blood.
Yes. Yeah, so there's that misnomer there, right? Because, you know, all these adverts out there like Floridex saying take iron because it helps energy. Yeah. Actually, excess iron makes you feel crap. You know, people having iron infusions in different places, you know, if the level's too high. So again, going back to balance. So the iron thing is one thing with you. So with people with hemochromatosis, and this is recognized in the NHS, you undergo something called giving blood, therapeutic phlebotomy. So you go to Blood Donation UK and you say you're doing this for altruism, and if you haven't got any diseases, they'll take your blood from you and your iron level will drop down. And that takes the burden off your liver, heart, other organs. Hmm. So I do encourage people.
So just before we go into saliva, urine and feces here.
I haven't done your other bits of the blood as well.
Oh, go on.
You know, you're
just before
vitamin
we get to
D
that,
a bit low, how, magnesium low, stress.
How healthy am I as an overview before we get stuck into this? Am I okay-ish?
Well, yeah, I often say you don't read people from their data. It's only part of what you
right,
do.
Right, okay.
Right? I speak to you and, you know, I feel like you're loads better than when we first met. But, you know, you're still on this trajectory of learning about yourself
yep.
and getting the right people involved to help you.
Right. So else in my blood, vitamin D is a bit low.
Magnesium was low, which is very common in people these days because magnesium is used up by stress, as it right. were, for want of a better sort of terminology. And we don't get enough of it in our diet anymore. Good common sources, you know, green leafy vegetables, maybe maybe Brazil nuts, can't off the top of my head. But, you know, magnesium is one supplement that I recommend globally for people because it helps so many aspects of the body.
So these are the sort of things that everybody out there might be suffering from. I'm not unique.
Very common. I have to say, you know, certain the common things are low vitamin D, low magnesium, higher iron in middle-aged men, especially if there's a history of drinking, or if I say they have this hemochromatosis gene, you know, that's common.
Okay.
It's not common in women, as I say, because they lose iron in menstruation, or most do. But actually, postmenopausally, or if you've been on the pill for a long time, you can get higher iron levels as a woman because you're not losing it in blood.
So if you were listening to this and you think, oh, I feel a bit lousy at the moment, I feel tired all the time, maybe I've got high iron, how do you go about testing that? Will doctors test for that?
I have to be a kind of gatekeeper to the NHS just ethically here. You know, just you can't overwhelm your doctor with wanting a blood test, but if you are genuinely really fatigued, then, you know, a standard blood test in the NHS, which looks at thyroid, which looks at iron, which looks at B12, which looks at vitamin D, is helpful. They don't tend to do that.
No.
And they don't give you the results and they don't do anything about it because they're too busy unless it's red. you could be right at the end of the range.
See, this is where we've got the problem, because I went for a blood test and they just said a low vitamin D, which is what you came back with. And so I had some vitamin D and that was it. But no one ever looked at my iron, or if they did, they didn't tell me about it. So
they wouldn't have done that. I mean, they rarely do it in people. So, you know, there's lots of consumer health testing companies popping up now, which, you know, Medichex, Thriver. It's affordable to do a blood test. You know, if you can prick your finger at home, you can drop a few drops of blood into a pot and send it off. They're fairly accurate for things like iron and thyroid. I still think that the ranges need to be made more narrow for certain people, because at the moment we've got a range for you is the same as the range for me, which is nonsense. You know.
What about, let's go on to...
So to finish your question, that you can go online and buy a blood test. You know, we do blood testing all the time, but we're not the cheapest because we also do the analysis. But companies like Medichex, Thriver, THRIVA do offer them relatively inexpensively.
Okay, so let's go on to, which one should we do next? Urine, saliva?
So the urine test you did this complicated test called the Dutch test.
Yeah, I was looking at my hormone levels, wasn't it?
Which is a wonderful test when I can get people to do it, but it's £400. Yeah. And it's a 5-step spit, saliva, and 5-step urine test where you pee on thick strips of paper. Did I have one
here last time? I don't know. It's fine. They're like strips of paper. You wee on them.
Keep them in my bag just to show people. But you wee on them and then send them off. What that does is give us not just the snapshot, which a blood test does.
Yeah.
So your blood levels of certain things change frequently. Especially hormones. Your hormone levels are going up and down all the time. Your cortisol, your testosterone in response to your environment. Mm-hmm. You know, that's normal. So the measuring over the course of 24 hours gives us more insight into what your body is doing with hormones. But specifically, the Dutch test, dried urine test, comprehensive hormones, looks at the stress system in the body, the adrenal glands. And everyone's heard about burnout, adrenal fatigue.
Adrenal fatigue, yeah.
It's a concept which isn't quite right. You know, the body doesn't actually just give up and stay in a state of fatigue. There are ways to improve it. It's more of a down regulation, a brain saying, you can't keep going like this because you're going to burn yourself out. Mm. So it stops you. It makes you retreat, which is what burnout and adrenal fatigue feels like. Horrible. So that gives you an insight into that and whether you're still producing lots of cortisol or you're at the other end of the spectrum, burnout, which is low cortisol, low DHEA, other things. It looks at that. It shows us how you're metabolizing, processing your testosterone. Lots of men convert their testosterone to estrogen, especially if they've got a liver that's not working amazingly, one that may be full of iron, especially if they are eating junk, their gut's not working well. There's a genetic component to how well you detoxify, process things. And also there's the whole thing about environment estrogen exposure. So we get estrogens from plastics, from, you know, drinking our coffee out of our coffee club. We get it through the tap water because loads of women are on the pill and it's leaking into the water source. So our male exposure to environmental estrogens goes up, and estrogens make you store fat. They make you feel fuggy. They reduce the effectiveness of the testosterone, which makes you male. So there's a kind of balance there. So for us, when we looked at your Dutch test, you were kind of okay on the testosterone, but you were off the charts on your estrogen. So what we did is say we need to work on, you know, supporting your liver. We need to get the we need to get you clearing your estrogens more so that your effective testosterone levels go up. Mm. Now, I usually get people then to gut test to see if we can fix something there. At the same time, we use something called DIM and other supplements, which is actually found in broccoli, which help stop that conversion of testosterone to estrogen. Okay, so there's a nutritional component. And then sometimes, in some men, to give them a kickstart, we do use a low dose of an estrogen blocker, a medication, which I advise for you, perhaps just to see how you've felt the difference, if you felt the difference from having less estrogen in your body, whilst we did the underlying work on treating the gut, supporting the liver, getting you to give blood eventually, those kinds of things.
Okay, so
no quick fixes, just a bit of information.
So you talked then about gut, that's where the feces comes into it. I had to give some feces samples, and you're looking then for interesting gut health, is that right?
I'm looking at gut health, but I'm also looking at if there's any bugs in the system. So, you know, people understand about treating or looking for and treating, you know, parasites or maybe food poisoning or foreign bugs you've picked up, traveler's diarrhea, etc. But actually these tests are looking at gut health generally. So they're looking if you've got overgrowth of certain bacteria. Certain bacteria, if they overgrowth, and we're not going to go into too detail here because I have talked about this on somewhere else, we can link to it. We want to kill off the bad stuff, including excess yeast, just to give your whole system a chance to recover. You need to take out dietary triggers if there's inflammation in the gut. So it will tell us if there's inflammation in the gut. It'll tell us how you're digesting your food. It'll tell us if you're feeding the good bacteria enough by looking at the levels of short-chain fatty acids. It'll also tell us your gut immunity. So the test tells us a lot of information about the good, the not so good, the environment that the bugs are living in, and then it tells us what to do about it. And for you, we're saying, you know, as anyone with chronic stress appears to have reduced gut immunity, and that's what we saw when we did your test, that your gut immunity was low, and that meant that things were overgrowing in the gut, taking hold, that otherwise your immune system would be able to fight off, including candida.
And what does that mean?
Candida is a yeast.
Right, okay.
And that is kind of cause and consequence of sugar craving. So it can make your blood glucose levels, your sugar levels fluctuate because the yeast eat up the glucose.
Okay, and then let's wander on to the I don't sound very healthy, do I? Let's wander on to the last
one. I have to say, look, having run about 400 of these tests, you weren't bad.
Okay.
I mean, I did my own and I had like two types of parasites.
Did you?
A bit of C. diff. I had Giardia, which is I've had for years.
And what's Giardia?
Giardia is a type of parasite that lives in sort of dirty waters, and you know, loads of athletes have swam in dirty lakes and waters, etc. So I had that, but you know, no doctor picked up on that, and I'd done a few stool tests at different points, but because the test is so detailed. Almost, it looks at the DNA of different bugs. It picks up stuff. So I treated that, and you know, I was just given a diagnosis of IBS for years.
Oh.
And
God, that really worries me.
I don't have IBS anymore.
But it worries me so much because I don't think the National Health can deal with all this. This is why we kind of need AI now, and we need to be able to do these tests. My brother, who as you know, died of cancer, he was diagnosed with IBS. I think so many people out there are diagnosed with IBS. Turns out he had pancreatic cancer.
Oh my God, that same story with my stepmom.
And it's such a sad, but I don't blame the NHS because what can they do? They can't take every single person and go, right, we're going to give you a myriad tests just to see if you've got cancer or not. That's what they can't do. What they've got to do is when people come back and say, I've still got this, that's when they have to start investigating. But it's tough, isn't it? It's tough because there's so many things that could be wrong with you. It's so hard for them to find them all out.
Yeah, and I thought a lot about this question because, you know, I have the ethical thing in my head about the test being so expensive, but you know, we need to get to the model like 23andMe did, the famous genetic test, which is now on the shelves at Boots. That started by, you know, the wife of Sergey, Google founder. I mean, they funded the cost of the test to get the data to inform the AI, right?
Right.
Now, you know, so I think the big companies, Apple, Google, Amazon, owe it to society to give some of their billions back to test more people, look at the correlations between people, yes, how people feel and function, and track them over time.
Yeah.
Set up an Apple Health clinic, right? Mm. You know, get people to give blood. Let's look at multiple bits of healthy people's blood,
yeah,
and start seeing how that correlates with things over time.
Mm. Let's do the last one then, saliva, because that is the 23andMe, isn't it? I did.
Actually, saliva was part of the Dutch test, but you also did the genetic test. Which we have only seen the 23andMe dashboard as yet. So we can't really touch too much upon that. But, you know, I am inferring from it that you had, I mean, it didn't really tell you much, did it?
Thing you got out of it, I remember, is the iron thing again. It was a confirmation that I had too much iron, wasn't it?
Correct. But you had you were a carrier of the hemochromatosis gene. So there's two parts.
Carrier, that makes me sound terrible. Well, put me in isolation, quickly.
You get
me.
Two copies of the hemochromatosis gene. If you had two copies, you would be full-blown hemochromatosis, right, which means you'd probably be a lot sicker than you are now. And the NHS would take you on board and say, hey, have your free therapeutic phlebotomy to get your blood levels down. Mm. That is a thing that happens in the NHS. But often people go undiagnosed with hemochromatosis because they don't know to ask, you know. Mm. And then...
Just, okay, so let's try and sort of get some summing up here, because I've got in front of me...
So the other things we will look at from your 23andMe, your genetic test, is things as it relates to longevity. So there's something called the FOXO3 gene, which tells you how well, if you're going to live longer, tells you how, if you're better on a high-fat diet or low-carbohydrate diet. It also gives you your methylation status, something called the motherfucker gene, which anyone, which a lot of people with a history of anxiety... But are very driven personalities often have this MTHFR motherfucker gene, either two copies, homozygous.
The problem
or
is
one.
Though, I got it all back and I can't read it. That's the problem.
I think 23andMe at the moment, they're improving their dashboard all the time, but it gives you kind of really silly information now, taste sensitivity.
I might be left-handed or something. Something like
they're
that.
Kind of gamifying it, but actually the raw data is there and different.
I can't read it though. So you get the data back and then it means nothing to me. That's the problem.
I think genetics, unfortunately, are very, very limited at the moment. I think companies are making claims that they can't really. Conclusively, because as I said last time, genes load the gun, environment pulls the trigger. Mm. So are your genes being expressed? The environment in which you live, how you live, like, you know, how you sleep, how you exercise, how you interrelate with people, that shows how your genes are they expressed or not? And there's one company now that have launched this genes load the gun, environment pulls the trigger product. So it shows you whole genome and then which is being switched on. Then you change your life and you see how can you turn the genes off. That's the future, being able to see your genetic expression. That company is called Chronomics. But again, £1,500 for a test for a year.
That's a lot of money, isn't it? So I've ended up with all these supplements. I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 sort of supplements. And there's also more to come for my gut. It becomes a bit overwhelming. I think that's the problem.
So one pillar of what we're trying to do, and we are doing with my company, is taking those, putting them in three easy sachets or even two sachets, morning, noon.
Oh, that'd be a great idea.
Have it in your bag.
Yeah, because I don't know.
Does exist.
Yeah.
But at the moment, I actually, because I work so intensively with clients, I actually go to the house and I do things like I've done for you here, like write on the bottle, calm, brain, sleep. Yeah. So this is something called Insomnitol. It contains 5-HTP, which supports serotonin levels, your natural happy hormone. Tiny bit of melatonin, which actually is a prescribed substance in the UK, not in America or France. And a bit of B6, which is calming for the nervous system. So there's kind of the pillars here. Adrenal support, Adrenatone. All of these are medical grade products by a company called Designs for Health. So they have good doses, like clinically proven doses, if you look at the research, of things we know can support you. A lot of the vitamins in Holland and Barrett Boots, they're tiny doses and they're crap formulas, so they don't get absorbed. You actually just like peel, wee or poo them out, or they've got lots of fillers, which are so there's different pillars here. Adrenal support, alpha GPC is a nootropic, but it's what they call a choline donor. It improves choline function in the brain, which helps sort her memory, mood, vocabulary, lots of things. Really good drug.
Oh,
gives you vivid dreams.
Vocabulary.
Lipoic acid is a glutathione precursor, one of the major antioxidants. Supports your liver function. That'll help your iron levels come down, alongside giving blood. Omegatropic is a combination of glycerol, phosphatidylcholine, and omegas, fish oils, in a high dose, good quality. This one should keep in the fridge so that the fish oils keep stable. Got a liquid form of curcumin, turmeric, which is highly bioavailable, so absorbed very well. That's an anti-inflammatory. That's to help with all your muscle aches, pains, and also indirectly improve inflammation in the mind. And we know that that is correlated with mood. So all of these have multiple benefits. That's alpha GPC, and then there's one more, which is actually called phenylparacetam, again, a nootropic. That is separate and, you know, actually slightly controversial, but is used by a lot of executives to improve brain focus,
controversial
mood.
Because
well, it's controversial in terms of, you know, you can't prescribe it. And it's difficult to kind of, you can buy nootropics online all the time now, but, you know, it does seem to have real, it's strong effects.
It's moving so quickly. Is it hard for you to keep up?
Well, this is why I'm like on it all the time. Yeah, actually, a client asked me that today, like, how do you ever switch off? The hardest thing for me is finding like-minded individuals who really get this, because I always used to feel like, you know, I was kind of like the square thing in the round hole.
Yeah.
And now, you know, even my mum goes, you know, rings me up and said, "Mum, Tam, it's on the front page of the Times that gut health's important, or that inflammation in your brain causes depression and anxiety disorders. You were talking about this 3 years ago." I'm like, "Yeah, thanks, Mum." So it's nice that we're all moving towards figuring this stuff out, that your biochemistry affects your psychology, which affects how you feel and the kind of lifestyle choices, that this interrelationness is there. And the problem with conventional medicine as it's set up is that it's all siloed. You go to your GP, you can't handle everything, and he pushes you to your neurologist, the cardiologist, and there's not the interconnectedness. So we need tech to kind of, as you say, AI, to make these so that the doctor then can bring it to life.
I'm going to ask you finally the impossible question then to answer for all our listeners out there. What I mean, obviously we could do the sort of eat well, have some exercise and do all that sort of stuff, but what can they do if they're feeling a bit crap about themselves and sluggish? They just have to keep looking online, seeing where the tests are coming up. What would your advice be to them?
No, I think it's very hard to navigate this. There are, you know, podcasts are a really good source of information. But because it is so personal, I think it is important to try and, you know, get some information about yourself and find a practitioner that can help navigate it. I don't want to overwhelm people with this. You know, the common, we can do all the testing in the world, but certain things are, you know, the output is similar. Okay. Mm. Take the supplements away, take the treatment away, you know, the pillars of your life, right? Finding time for you to exercise, to get light in the morning, to cut off the blue light in the evening, to look at your purpose, your passion in life, to work on, you know, your gut health through changes in your diet, figure out what works for you. And if changing up things, if following, you know, I don't know, Deliciously Ella diet or it doesn't work for you, then try and invest some time and maybe even money to get more information.
I always think the thing which stuck out with my interview with Tim Spector was when he said that he was lacking B12 because he'd gone on a vegetarian diet. And then he went, "Well, I ate some red meat and my B12 went up." And he thought, "Well, actually, that's the best way of doing it rather than trying to take the supplements." Exactly. And it's kind of, it's that weird thing that if you end up on one of those diets, it's a bit of a minefield.
Yeah, I don't like the binary diets. I think this is a complex field, and you becoming self-aware is helpful. I think going on a carnivore diet or a paleo diet or that kind of diet, it's hard because it's easy to get things wrong. You know, people get ketogenic ketosis diets wrong frequently, and they trash their sex hormones and their thyroid, for example. So eat more nutrient-dense food. Have your shot of apple cider vinegar with your food if you can. You know, we all know to avoid refined sugar where we can, you know, to limit and moderate alcohol intake and drink in a social environment. We know that, you know, people who are moderate drinkers live longer than teetotalers, but that's not due to an effect on the alcohol. It's due to the effect that what alcohol does to you.
Yeah.
Puts you in places that open you up and change up your, you know, anyway, you get that. So I think, you know, basic principles, you know, air, movement, light, relationships, job, posture, and then trying to avoid, you know, commercial plastic foods wherever possible, filtering your water, glass bottles, all of that. I mean, it's complex, But try and do small things every day and don't get overwhelmed. Go, oh, it's not going to make a difference.
Yeah, it's a minefield. There's so much. I listen to so many podcasts on it and I end up finding it's just such a minefield. But I enjoy it all. I'm doing a lot of sauna treatment at the moment, as you know, because I enjoy that. Rhonda Patrick tells me it's good. So, okay, well, listen, thank you so much.
So for you, like, you know, the key things were, you know, working on the liver.
Yeah.
Getting your detox better so that you, and getting your iron levels down. We know that there are adrenal issues as it relates to chronic stress. So supporting you there, having an awareness is one, you know, doing mindfulness, breath work, breathing, getting, improving your sleep, you know, changing your outlook, doing therapy, all of that affects that. And then, you know, with the gut health, we didn't do any treatment for it because you were going into the Timber Spectra trial. I usually kill off yeast. I usually give things like colostrum, zinc, high doses of zinc to improve gut barrier function and immunity. So your gut treatment protocol would help too, especially given that you told me about your fluctuations in blood sugar.
Yeah, that's the one thing I noticed from Tim Spector as well. There's the everything.
But we will get to the place. We will get to the place where you can be your own health detective.
So if people want to follow you and ask you questions, at Sporty Doc, SPORTI.DOC is where you're at on Twitter. Where else do you, is that it, where you basically?
We're overhauling everything at the moment, and right. I really do need a top PA stroke practice manager. So if anyone's interested in this and they
there
know.
You go. Jobs, and that's they what know we're offering as well.
Definitely, I mean, like-minded people, creating the tribe, the team, is really important, but I definitely need social media management.
There you go. We're recruiting whilst we're on air as well. I think you should do a podcast as well. I think with who's your colleague?
Victoria.
Yeah,
I'd love to
do. I think you should
podcast.
Start doing one. It's just, you know, one.
I just don't want to be another, you know, add on to all the podcasts. That
I just I think there's always a demand for health, and people like to do it, and then they can ask you questions directly, and you can talk about it or help people. But maybe,
and then I can get the word out to more people instead of spending loads of time with individuals.
Exactly. So that could be the future. Listen, thank you so much, and you can always welcome to come back on this podcast.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. Cheers. That was Dr. Tamsin Lewis. The bit I was fascinated, obviously I'm interested in my health, but the bit I'm fascinated most about that is the minefield of doping. When you start meeting someone like Tamsin and she starts saying, well, you can take this supplement here, that supplement there, she knows her way around all these drugs and they're getting very advanced. And then it's a minefield. What is cheating?
It's
and what
mind-boggling.
Yeah. What is cheating and what is actually okay to take as a supplement? What's your views on Lance Armstrong?
Oh, God. I mean, he's obviously brilliant, but he did, as you said in the podcast, he did let everyone down. It's because he was such a massive tool with it as well. You know, he was so sort of aggressive at everyone who questioned it. And you just think, now you look like a colossal bell end.
And the problem with it is he'd been made so famous from Nike and his... Yeah. His cancer treatment, which he was phenomenal to get through cancer. Was it twice he's got through cancer? Yeah. I can't remember, at least once. And then it's the Live Strong. Do you remember the yellow rubber band things we all used to wear on our arms? Yeah. And so he became so huge. And then to find out that he was cheating was horrific. What do you think about people who get found out for doping? Should they be
hung, drawn, and quartered, Tim?
Do you think? death penalty.
I think, sure.
Is it worth bringing about the death penalty? Yeah. My friend's dad.
They should be sit and made to watch Love Island constantly with the matchsticks in their eyes, like on Clockwork Orange.
That film's so good, isn't it? I keep thinking about Clockwork Orange. It keeps coming up for some bizarre reason at the moment. I don't know why it's doing the rounds again. And it was such a great film. Once you've watched it, you think, the first time you watch it, you think, this is like nonsense. And then you wake up the next day and go, I want to watch it again. And then, you know, it's just one of those films which sticks with you. My friend's dad used to make me laugh. He used to always, he was one of those really angry men. And the thing he was most, you'll be like it when you're older. And the thing he was most angry about was litter. And litter and grammar. I mean, like, and people who, he was really angry about to boldly go where no men have gone before. That used to make him really angry. You know, on Star Trek, for some reason, that's grammatically correct or something. Yeah. And he used to always say, what's it say? To boldly go. No, it's to go boldly. He says. And then he used to always say, just
I like the sound of him.
Oh, he made me laugh because he used to always say they should be strung up from the nearest lamppost. That was his catchphrase. And I could just sort of, when he said it, I could just visualize this, you know,
sort
like
a row of lamppost.
Town.
With some bloke with a crisp packet. Well,
what did he do? Littered, bad grammar. Right, so on the next podcast, we'll discuss the death penalty and bringing back corporal punishment.
No, we will not.
Well, no, oh, okay. I thought we had a guest on that.
Fear points on from the dead.
Please let us know if you're interested in anything we've discussed today or you just want to comment. Or keep your problems coming in because we'll be doing another mailbag soon.
We promise we won't be talking about Tim's shit anymore.
Yeah. We're going to try.
Because it's been pretty plop heavy, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, we're going to try and swerve that now. Amount of feces tests I've done. Do you know what?
I'm surprised you've got any. The thing is, you are full of it, so it's totally fine.
I am an expert at collecting it now. Anyway, that's it for the time being. You can email us at dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com or you can obviously tweet me at Tim Lovejoy. We'll see you soon. For the time being, peace and love, joy.
Bye.